Hello, welcome or welcome back to the Just Eat Normally podcast for eating disorder recovery with me, Dr. Rachel Evans. I am a psychologist, hypnotherapist with a PhD in the psychology of eating and specialist training in eating disorder recovery, as well as personal experience of going through an eating disorder and coming out the other side, which makes me super passionate about what I do. And in every episode, as with my one-to-one clients, I'm bringing you academic knowledge, information, and theories, as well as therapeutic skills and personal experiences, be that mine or experiences of my guests, for a unique perspective on eating disorder recovery. So join me on this podcast as I speak to fellow experts in eating disorder recovery, eating disorder survivors with inspiring stories, and also throw in some bite-sized solo episodes with recovery tips or new ways for you to think about things. The goal of this podcast is to give you food for thought, to shift your mindset, to boost your motivation, and to help you find your own version of normal eating, which will allow you to live a truly nourished life.
Hi everyone, welcome back. I am here with Meg McCabe, who is joining us from over the ocean in America. And she is a coach, an educator, a writer, a mental health advocate and recovered eating disorder warrior, obsessed with podcast, dancing and stand-up comedy. She's the creator of Baby Got Back Recovery, a coaching and recovery blog that has touched thousands. And she also has her own podcast, which is called The Full and Thriving Podcast, designed to support your recovery while helping you rediscover your radiant life outside of your eating disorder. So welcome.
Hi, Rachel. Thank you so much for having me today.
You're welcome. Is there anything else that you would like to add about yourself?
Yes, absolutely. I'm realizing I have to update my biography on my website.
Okay.
I do. So I'm a one-on-one recovery coach through the Carolyn Costin Institute. And I also am the founder of the Recovery Collective, which is an online membership, which is for folks who just need a little bit of a recovery community. And so people can join that and gain different like workshops and educational resources like on a monthly basis. So I would say that those are my two main things. And then the Full and Thriving podcast is absolutely a huge passion of mine as well. So that's me in a nutshell. And I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah. Well, I also need to update my website. It's one of those things, isn't it? They go like, right, I should do that. And then like 10 other tasks get in the way.
That's like literally the bane of my existence is my website. I do not like updating it. It is always the last thing on my to-do list. And it would probably help me if I got around to doing it. So yeah, maybe today's the day.
I don't know if you find yourself like, because I haven't updated certain bits, and then I end up typing this really long email to someone about it that could just be on a website, and I'll be like, just go and look at this link. But oh well. Yeah, I have actually seen the Recovery Collective on Instagram.
Cool.
Sharing your posts, maybe. I'm not sure, but when you were saying that, I'm like, oh yeah, I've seen you hanging around on that.
Yes, we do have a little bit of a presence on Instagram. We're 2 years old now at this point. 2 years old in February, and the community has grown to about 90 people. So it's a nice little group of folks from all over the world who need community and recovery, which is a huge value of mine, community in general, building connection. So yeah, it's been a big, big part of my life.
Yeah. Is that kind of like a drop in, drop out thing as well? People can sign up for like 1 month or like kind of 2 months, they're not kind of locked in, or is it a certain amount?
Yes. Right now we ask for a 3 month commitment because we want people to really kind of sink their teeth in. 1 month you need to like get yourself assimilated into the group, start of out of your comfort zone. So we do 3 month renewal process with the members, and it's great, honestly. We also have two leaders in the community who've been there for at least a year each. And they are just incredible. They actually do individual welcome meetings for new members during that first month that they join. So a person who joins randomly and is nervous to maybe get on their first call, they at least have that friendly face from that private meeting, that welcome meeting, to kind of that person shows them the ropes and helps them integrate into the community. So yeah, that's why we do 3 months. We just want to make sure everyone gives it their all, you know, when they come in.
Yeah, no, I've signed up for stuff, say it's a month by month basis, and then you either forget about it for the whole month, and then you're like, oh no, now I need to go in the second month. Or like, you just try and cram so much in or do so much and learn so much that is a bit overwhelming, and then kind of give up on that. So I think 3 months sounds like a nice amount of time for people to like get the feel of it. And
yes, build your own rhythm. Like, we have people coming to different classes. Like, throughout the month, we offer about 12 hours of content live that people can drop in and drop out of. And it's pretty cool because we have some regulars going to our Nourish and Learn sessions where we're cooking together, but they never go to yoga, right? And then we have our group coaching people who always love to go to group coaching and maybe peer support. So it's like, you make what you want out of it. You're not required to go to every single session. Some people do, which we love. It's really cool when that happens, but you really do make it your own.
Oh, that's really good. I'm glad that we talked about it on here. It wasn't planned. I think I would like aspire to run something like that, but it's just too much for my brain to be like dealing with. But I think it's something that is really needed, because I think a lot of people kind of like that group thing. Obviously, like, there's different benefits to one-to-one and things, but I think a lot of people kind of thrive more in a group as well.
Yeah, I completely see that too. And that's why we created it, kind of to fill that need. And this is not a replacement for treatment by any means, which I think is really important for everyone to know. I always say this community work is just your little, like, chance to recharge your battery, right? And surround yourself with people who are at least relating to what you're going through and going through similar things. And there's that outlet where you can reach out for help. So it really does benefit the folks who do join. But I highly recommend people also have, you know, a therapist, dietitian, coach, you know, their own unique path to recovery in addition to this.
Okay. Yeah. So
anyway,
into the podcast. I was just really interested about that. So what was your relationship with food and your body like when you were growing up?
Oh, such a good question. And it's such a loaded question. So first of all, I would say I was very blessed to have a happy childhood. Like, I am lucky. I had a very supportive family. I went to a nice school in Connecticut, like, cute little life. But of course, like, we have no control over what type of body we have, the way our families like deal with emotions or things like that. So I think the thing that sticks out to me the most is when I was younger, I was always so much taller than everyone else. So that always made me feel a little out of place. And then I also, during puberty, like, was just very, like, didn't develop the same speed. I was kind of a late bloomer. So that made me feel like I wasn't enough, right? Everyone around me was like becoming a woman, and I was just this lanky beanpole. And I felt really ashamed of that and embarrassed. And to add to that, I have an identical twin sister. So imagine like the awkwardness of puberty, but externalized in your face all day, like in the form of your identical twin. like talk about another level of constantly being reminded of your own body insecurities. So I would say my relationship with my body was a little complicated because of those factors, but I was an athlete. So that was helpful. And as far as food goes, I think there was some dieting going on in my household, but I was so immersed into it, I didn't necessarily identify that. And I didn't start consciously dieting to lose weight until high school, when this is actually so funny. So because I'm so tall, when America's Next Top Model came out. I don't know if you remember that show at all, but.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I became obsessed with that show, and I live right next to New York. And I was like, I know what I'm going to do with my life. I'm going to become a runway model like all of these American Next Top Model girls. And so I started obsessively losing weight so that my body could match the girls on that show. And I don't know if you remember this, but that show was so triggering because they actually posted the girls' weights on there and all of their measurements. So like chest, hips, waist, everything was on the TV. So I just started actually measuring myself and comparing like, okay, I can get to this. This is sort of achievable. Let me just lose weight and all of that. And that's kind of what spiraled into the eating disorder, right? I don't know if I'm going, is there anything you want to add or comment on?
No, I definitely watched a lot of America's Next Top Model. I'll link in the show notes if anyone's interested. There's a really interesting, I can't remember what her name is, someone on YouTube who goes through the videos now and like does a commentary on them. She's a photographer, so she's kind of commenting on the photography side of things, but also just how they treated the models and saying like, this is not okay. Like, I think, do you know, she's kind of picking up on when they did like the bikini photo shoots or like underwear ones with models and then male models, and say the contestant wasn't happy about it and they're basically being forced to do it, otherwise they'll have to leave. And that, like, 2022, we're like, oh, I don't think that was okay.
Well, I'll tell you this, my dieting did get me there. So I ended up signing on with a agency in New York for, and I did that instead of go to college for a few months. Didn't last because diets aren't sustainable and my body was, it rebelled. It didn't want to be in that size. So the whole modeling career was very fleeting and fast for me, because they were not into like curve models or like plus size modeling back then. It was just like, you need to be this way or you're out. You're very replaceable, very dehumanized. How they treat the models on that show was exactly how I was treated at photo shoots. And that was really eye-opening to me as well. And to consent to be treated like that, like I was totally willing to be dehumanized because modeling seemed like this achievement. I wanted to be that special person who could say she did that and was on that cover or on, you know, did this brand or whatever. And, you know, looking back now, I feel so sad that there is a part of my worth missing, right? I had no voice. I had no life perspective. I was a teenager. So, you know, if I was put in that position now, I think I'd advocate for myself a little bit and ask for basic needs. Like, oh, I would like to eat on set. That would be nice. I'd like to have a changing room. Because a lot of times we'd be changing in front of the entire set of people because we had to, and it's like just things like that, that I really lost sight of. It's really sad. It's really sad to think about.
Yeah, I suppose if you go into it though, and that's the norm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also you've seen on America's Next Top Model that I can't remember what they called them, but they definitely got told off for, like you say, advocating for themselves on stuff. Like, you, if you want that outcome so much, you are just gonna fall in line, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah. You're just replaceable. I mean, at the end of the day, there are people who maybe are willing to be treated that way or worse, and they can suck it up and get there. Where, I mean, I was definitely one of those people who thought it was worth it, and I was really young. So I think it exposes a lot and mistreats a lot of young people. That's another problem with the industry, is they'll lie about their age. I was 18. I was 17, 18, but I was working with girls who were 13, who agencies would lie to the photographers and say, oh, they're 18, and they weren't, because they're from a foreign country and there's really no regulation in that industry on like labor laws and things like that. Maybe, I think things have changed now, but this was maybe 2008, 2009 when all of this was happening. So, yeah.
Wow. Okay. So from there, I guess, like you say, you're body didn't want to be in that size. I guess, how did that feel for you that you put so much effort into this diet and trying to get modeling, then that wasn't happening, I guess?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So I didn't have words for set point theory back then. I had no idea that our bodies are kind of pre-programmed to be a certain size based on genetics and ancestry and all of that. So I just had this inner wisdom that my body did not want to be in that place. It wanted to be in its natural size. And it just felt like this force of nature that I was fighting against. Like, I had this feeling, this is not sustainable. I know that I've achieved the size that I want, but I can feel this overpowering force of nature pulling me back to where my body wants to be. And it's like a, it's like, I'm picturing a, what, like a river dam or something, you know, when all the water is just like held in place. And like, if the dam was just cracked open, all the water would burst through. That's what it felt like. It felt like I was like resisting a massive force of nature. And that's exactly what happened. Like my river dam cracked open and suddenly I became really chaotic with my eating disorder. I always had it was like anorexia with a binge purge subtype. And then it just became a lot of binge eating, like intensely. It just felt like I went from having the eating disorder in control to everything just becoming really chaotic. And I eventually kind of had to check myself out of the modeling industry and come to terms with the fact that I had an eating disorder. I needed to recover. It was not worth it to be in that state. And it wasn't even possible. Like, I'm so grateful that my younger self had the wisdom to recognize my own kind of biological reality was not that. So that's what it felt like. It just felt like this thing I could not fight forever, even though I wanted to.
I guess when you were doing the modeling and things, did people realize that you had an eating disorder at that point?
It's really weird. I still find this with the modeling industry. I feel like it's so normalized over there, and people might not even recognize it because everyone's in it, and or everyone's just really good at swiping it under the rug. So nobody ever talked to me about it. Nobody brought it up. I was living in a modeling apartment with, I would say, anywhere up to 8 girls at a time. And we all had very weird relationships with food. There were scales in every bedroom. So we're all constantly weighing ourselves, kind of monitoring what the other people were eating. It was just a very messed up environment. We probably all had some sort of disordered relationship with food, but none of us talked about it.
Yeah, I suppose it's like if you call it out on someone else, they're going to call it out on you, and you want to. I was going to say, on some level, people know what they're doing isn't okay. But then also on some other level, you think it's perfectly okay and it's what you have to be doing.
That's how I felt.
You don't want someone to take it away from you. So there's a kind of knowing that maybe this isn't okay.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, like, the one girl who seemed to have the best relationship with food in the house was by far the most successful of all of us, which is interesting.
Okay.
It was like it looked like she was nourishing herself, honoring her body. Her body was just, that was her natural body's shape. You know, there are people like that. It's very rare. But she seemed to be thriving, and I can't help but think maybe that's because she wasn't like kind of hurting herself with constant dieting and food obsession and all of that.
Yeah, I'm sure you talk to clients as well about like the benefits of eating in terms of energy, concentration. Like, she's got all those faculties available to her, where maybe everyone else in the apartment, they're kind of being dimmed down a bit, or things are just harder than they need
Absolutely.
to be.
Yeah. That was totally it.
Yeah, I was just thinking about America's Next Top Model when they had to do the go-sees and stuff, and then that always looked really stressful.
Oh my gosh, it was like extremely stressful because you're walking around Manhattan, you have to go, this was before Google Maps. So a lot of it's trying to learn the city without the internet showing you how. Like I had an actual physical map that I found. And you have to be places on time, and then you're treated it's kind of like a cattle call when you're in there. It's just not ideal, and it hurts your feet because you're always in heels and
Interesting life experience to have, though.
yeah, it feels like a total different life, and I'm glad I did that. I think I learned a lot about what it's like to be treated like a human, right? Like human, what it means to be humanized, and also that whole recovery experience that's really what inspired me to start recovery, was when everything got really chaotic and I recognized the lifestyle wasn't sustainable. So I focused on recovery after that and I never looked back.
Yeah. So now you work with clients who are recovering from eating disorders. And what do you see that are their like most common hang-ups in recovery?
Yeah, so this is a topic I love to talk about because I love to get in people's worlds, right? It's like they don't realize they're doing this. And I love to call out the hangups so that people recognize, as a coach, these are patterns I see throughout, like across the board with people who come to me. And I can always think of so many hangups, but today I have about four I'd love to share with you today. Hopefully we get to them. I even have a fifth one, but we'll see how far we get. But the first hangup that I see in recovery, especially people who are focused on recovery, and I'm sure you see this all the time, people who are like the A plus recovery students. So they're consuming all the podcasts, they're watching all the YouTube videos, they're maybe going to all of their therapy sessions and dietitian or whatever they need. However, they're not taking action and they're not challenging themselves with food. So that's the first hangup I see, is people will kind of like gaslight themselves into being like, oh, I'm recovering. Look at me doing all of this recovery work. But when it comes down to it, they are still hyper controlling around where they take action with food. And that's one I see all the time. Do you see that one when you work with folks as well?
Sometimes I would say not all the time, because I'm quite lucky in that I kind of have quite selective clients, the people who would want to work with me, and like criteria about how ready are they. I feel like if someone wasn't going to take any action, I might have been able to tell before they started working with me. I think just because of the price and stuff, it's people who are like, right, I need to for this now, for this, if I'm going to invest that money to recover. So I think just based on the client type, but yeah, I do see it sometimes, and definitely saw it before. It's almost like, but I'm doing the work by showing up, that's enough. Rather than, like you say, actually, what are these steps? I guess if, well, we'll come on to how you deal with it, but I was going to say, like, I guess if I see that from clients, then we talk about like what specific things are you going to do this week? Obviously, they don't do, they don't get told off, but trying to give them, I was going to say get their teeth into, is that too
I
cheesy?
use that expression all the time. I love that expression.
Yeah, like I guess what are your thoughts on if someone can relate to that, or like how you would treat, not treat in the, you know what I mean? I was going to say treat clients, but I hope you get the
What you
meaning.
mean. So, first of all, anyone listening to this, I just want you to gently like call yourself out if that is what's happening, 'cause I do see it. And they might not be, maybe you don't have a coach, maybe you don't have a psychologist or a therapist, but you are convincing yourself that you are working on recovery 'cause you're listening to all the things, right? Or consuming all the things. You really will not get anywhere if you're not challenging the food. Or maybe the the overt behaviors, right? So I want you to, like, one thing you could do is make a list of the overt behaviors that you are dealing with. Maybe that's excessive exercise. Maybe that's restricting this food group. Maybe it's, you know, whatever it is, purging. And try to find a coach or someone to work with who can build goals around taking action with those things. And I mean, it's that simple, but awareness matters. Maybe you do have someone you're working with, and every time they challenge you, you find a reason not to do it, or you know, just call yourself out and start recognizing that your progress depends on the action you take. It's not just the knowledge you have. So try to fill that gap.
Yeah. I don't know if this is going to come in your other hang up. So if it is, just stop me. Yeah. But do you find as well, like, the reason that people are doing that is different? So some people, it might be like they've just listened to so much that has told them so many different things that they're just overwhelmed. Say if they wanted to stop purging or something like that. There are so many different ways you could go about it that it's almost like they don't know which one to do first.
Yes. Oh my God.
Or sometimes it is more like, not an excuse, but like you don't actually want to let go of the eating disorder. So you're just saying, well, I'm doing these things, but it's because you haven't, you know, got the reason why. So I think there's different reasons.
Yes. And that's the thing. It's usually very unconscious, right? Like it's not like a malicious thing where you're like trying to manipulate everyone around you into thinking that you're recovering. Although some people do that. It's more, there might be some really valid reasons why you're not taking action, and just recognizing what those are can be really helpful, building awareness around that, expressing those to your team. But yeah, I think one problem with consuming so much content, if you fall into this little hang up group, is that your head will start to spin with all the directions you can go and what to work on first, which is really hard. And that's why it's important to hire a professional to guide you through the process.
Okay, hang up number two.
Okay, so here is another hang up that I see all the time. Okay, so first of all, you say you are in the place of challenging yourself. So somebody in you make a commitment to your team. I'm going to be adding this to the meal plan, or I'm going to do this food fear like a few times this week. I find that some folks only challenge themselves when conditions are perfect. So imagine, like, you're committed to adding this onto your meal plan this week, right? However, your work is really stressful. So you just let all of your commitments fall away, right? And then you come to your coaching session the next week and say, oh, well, I really couldn't do that because I was really stressed at work. And the reality in this situation is recovery takes committed, consistent action. So you need to actually get used to committing to your recovery, even when things are hard, even when things aren't ideal. You have, you know, maybe your dog gets sick and your eating disorder is going to take that as an excuse. Oh, well, you can't handle recovery today. Start recovery tomorrow. So I've seen this hang up where if conditions aren't perfect, everything falls away. And it's like, I think of a little house, like a structure of a house. And the house is made up of toothpicks. It's like the second a little gust of wind comes by, the recovery house just blows away, right? You want to make your house stronger than toothpicks, right? You want it to be strong. So when a gust of wind comes by, you have the ability to continue doing the strong recovery work. So that's one thing I see a lot as well.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think there's always going to be something else that comes along after whatever stress has just been the stress. When you're talking, I don't know if I'm like trying to be too nice to people, but I'm like, oh, like, you know, there are those things though, that I've had clients deal with, like a bereavement or something of like a parent, And it's like, okay, this is a big thing. Let's maybe work more this week on stress management. And then if that's going to help you be able to eat that thing, but will you, I'm like, am I colluding with the eating disorder? But, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, okay, actually, this is like a hurricane coming through rather than like the gust of wind, stressful day at work, which is, you know, going to happen quite
Right.
often.
There's definitely occasions where maybe you have to play it safe that week, but you still need to honor your recovery. What I see is maybe the hurricane comes in and you say, no recovery for me at all. I'm not even gonna keep the easy, safe foods here. I'm gonna be restricting again, behaviors again. Like there's that reverting, like giving your eating disorder has a reason to just come back full force. And of course, it's a case by case basis. And I think what we're really focused on are those, if this is happening to you regularly, like your eating disorder is finding a reason to come in and make you uncommitted on a regular basis. That's what I'm concerned about. Yeah.
Yeah. I take your point on that one. So
yeah.
What, I guess, would you recommend, or maybe you can't recommend on the podcast, I'm not sure. What would you say to people who recognize that in themselves?
I think, first of all, again, that a lot of these hangups are just an opportunity to call yourself out and really say, hey, this is a pattern of mine. Like, am I coming to my sessions with my dietitian and consistently giving them a reason why I couldn't do the work this week? And what's that all about? And why can't I commit when it's hard? Am I only, this is a tough like line to teeter, but I do find sometimes emotions, if someone's only doing recovery when their emotions are good, right, then you're not really going to get anywhere because life is 50-50. You need to work on recovery when the emotions aren't always positive. You need to be able to hunker down and commit. So that energetic commitment to what you've promised your team you do is necessary. So yeah, it's tough, but again, consistent communication with your team on this pattern is also probably going to help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think as well, like, it gets easier, doesn't it? If you've practiced it in what these feel like difficult situations, it's easier next time that same stressful situation comes up to do what you said that you were going to do. Whereas if you never challenge, and also I think the thing is as well, if someone's tried to do it and it hasn't gone well for whatever reason, whatever their goal was, like, that's okay, we can still talk about that in therapy.
Exactly.
It's a learning thing. That's, to me, a positive. It's
absolutely
great if people have just done it, well, hey, like, excellent, move on to the next thing. But if they haven't, that's also going in the right direction if they haven't achieved it, but they've tried in a way.
Yes, we want to normalize an attempt, right? Like, I hate to use the word fail, but yeah, it's like an unsuccessful attempt. We want to normalize that. There's nothing wrong with attempting to do things and not being able to. It's just a learning process. It's then following up with, okay, how can I make this more achievable? Should I break it down into a smaller goal? Should I, you know, talk to my team a little bit more about this? Like, maybe I need to incorporate more rest and self-care. Like, there are so many things you can do to make a commitment a little bit more achievable. Like, if you run into the pattern of constantly like making commitments to your recovery and then getting your house blown down, maybe it's a sign that your energy is like being dominated by work and you just don't have the energy to do recovery. So it's looking at the big picture too, and being like, if I constantly am not having the energy to hunker down when things are really hard, what's dominating my ability to do this? What's taking up that space? So whenever you make a commitment, here's a good tip. Whenever you make a commitment to make a change in your recovery, you have to be honest with yourself. Do I have the bandwidth to do this? Or should I make it a smaller change? And there's no judgment if that's what you need.
Yeah, I've been talking to my client recently about like making, what is the smallest step that we can take for this
it.
week? Okay, this is the biggest, not the biggest step, but like this is the goal. Say it was like not to purge this week. But then we were kind of talking about, okay, but if you could just wait like 10 seconds before you binge or like delay vomiting or getting rid of it, then that is still a step in the right direction, because it depends where you are in eating disorder or recovery. But just thinking like, oh, if I just need to stop this right now, it's often quite a lot. So what are the little steps? Little steps that she could do, because then I feel like next time it's going to be easier. You could wait for 20 seconds, and then people are like, oh, but 10 seconds, does it really make a difference? But it's going to over time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like you're always looking for evidence that you can do it and that your healthy self is inside of you. So even that delay of 10 seconds is a huge achievement, and we always want to honor and celebrate those and recognize that recovery is about building up strength. So it might take you a few times of that 10 second delay. And then maybe at one point you're going to say, okay, I'm going to shoot for 30 second delay. And then maybe it's 5 minutes one day. And then it turns into no longer using that behavior, right?
Yeah.
It's great.
Okay. Third hang up.
Third hang up. Let's do it. Okay. So another one that I see a lot, and these are all like sneaky. They're all sneaky. It's when your eating disorder likes to hijack the concept of intuitive eating. So what I mean by this is you are maybe, you know, there's always an element of intuition you can start to learn from and feel, even if you're in the very beginning of recovery. But with food, for instance, there might be a part of you that doesn't have your hunger signals or your fullness signals intact. And so you're hearing all this information about intuitive eating, and you just say, you know, I don't feel hungry today, so I guess I don't need to eat because I'm being intuitive. And you're not taking into account, oh, I actually haven't restored my hunger signals yet, so I can't claim intuitive eating as my thing right now. So the eating disorder will kind of use that idea of following your intuition. However, you do not have that, those signals back. And so I do see that a lot. And I see intuition being used as a reason not to eat when you're not fully in a place like of recovery strength to be there.
Yeah, I think that kind of middle phase is a bit difficult for people, isn't it? When like you say, like, maybe you're not hungry, but recognizing like with your logical brain, you don't need to eat today, can be quite difficult, because I think people want to just jump straight into like, I'm an intuitive eater. But that is not necessarily everyone's goal anyway. It doesn't need to be, but people want to kind of jump there. I was thinking when you're talking as well, let me get this through in my head. It makes sense when I get it out right. Almost that like people, do you know, like the principle of satisfaction? I did this, yes. I did this quite a lot of like convincing themselves, I'm satisfied when I eat this protein bar that basically actually tastes like chalk and is really horrible. I don't need a brownie. I'll just have this chocolate protein bar. And like some do taste fine. But like, do you know when you've eaten like an actual piece of cake and then you're like, oh, I just can't eat those bars
anymore? Oh my gosh.
It's that trick, which then I think leads people to binge quite often.
Absolutely. That is such a good example. Again, that's an example of taking one of those principles and manipulating it in your eating disorder's favor. So the satisfaction is such a good example. Like, I've seen people convince themselves that clean eating is really all they enjoy. And at the end of the day, you want to question that. Like, is this my authentic self talking, or is this my eating disorder trying to stay in control no matter what? And I love the example you just gave.
Yeah, I think when you were talking earlier as well about how it helps to see someone one-to-one, it's easier to have nuanced conversations about these things and ask them. So I do have some clients who, this is people who aren't severely restricting, But you know, they obviously need to eat for their body during the day. They're just not hungry in the morning. They're just not morning people, and we've discussed it at length. And we've decided it's not really feeding into the eating disorder. Okay, so they don't have breakfast. Whereas other people, this is not intuitive eating, but they're trying to fast in the morning when really, actually, intuitively, breakfast might be beneficial for them. My point in that was just, I think it's helpful to have these conversations and have someone reflect back to you what you're saying. Sometimes when you hear it, you're like, oh, actually, am I being honest with myself about this? Is that true? And to be able to keep coming back to it as well.
Yeah. It's so nuanced for everyone. And I think the best way to handle this hang up is to just recognize that intuitive eating is not something you wake up with. We were born with it, and then it gets deprogrammed, and then we're like lost for a while, right? Like if you're in have an eating disorder. So it's something that's learned over time. And what you need to do, no matter what, is eat yourself, feed yourself regularly, and be committed to that, even if you're not feeling the hunger and fullness. Practice asking yourself, what do I actually want? What will satisfy me? And I will say that one of the huge turning points in my recovery was starting to honor that satisfaction factor authentically. That's what made eating fun. That's what made eating feel exciting again, instead of so punishing and rigid, was honoring that and recognizing the intense verbal abuse and obsession that my eating disorder would give me would quiet down when I actually honored that. I highly recommend calling yourself out and seeing, where am I manipulating intuitive eating for the sake of my eating disorder?
Yeah, just one more point on this quickly.
Yeah.
So in the podcast that I recorded yesterday, which will be out just before this episode with Renee McGregor, we were kind of talking about how your eating disorder can filter things. Sometimes it's almost like you're reading the principles of intuitive eating, and people can almost read it like the hunger fullness diet, in terms of like, oh, I should only eat when I'm hungry, I should only stop when I'm full. But I guess if you're hearing it as that, that's not what is intended. I've got other episodes on the podcast about intuitive eating, I guess, if you got some as well, Meg. So maybe diving into a bit more to understand actually what is intuitive eating, like what it isn't as well.
Yes. Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think it is so much more than hunger and fullness. Intuition can be literally, it's rainy and cold outside, so I feel like having soup. It's not just your body being hungry or full. It's taking into consideration like your actual feelings, emotions, the state of like your environment. All of that. I'm starting to realize that that's so big for me as an eater, is taking in my environment and saying, how does this environment make me feel? And how do I want in this place? Right. And what sounds good, knowing that, like I'm going to like going to an Italian restaurant and, recognizing I really do want this like delicious creamy pasta with garlic bread and maybe a fresh salad. And I wouldn't want to order, like, I don't know, there are things at an Italian restaurant you wouldn't really want to have. Like, you're not going to want to have sushi at an Italian restaurant, you know? Like, intuitively, there's so many factors. It's not just hunger and fullness.
Yeah, right. I could say many things to that, but we'll go on to the last one, number four.
Oh, okay. So number I'm trying to decide which one I like better.
We'll do five. Number four.
Okay. Some of them kind of seem like, now that I'm looking at it, they kind of blur together. But another one that I see a lot is the obsessive need to negotiate and budget food, which is like the opposite of intuitive eating. It's like the obsessive over calculating, overthinking, budgeting, like, oh, if I have a carbohydrate for breakfast, I can only have one today and then I shouldn't have it later. And if I do that, I need to go to the gym this much. And there's this, I call it like the inner budgeter. And that's a total hang up in recovery. I'm sure you see that all the time. But again, it's a matter of calling yourself out and recognizing, why am I making it so complicated? Why am I overcomplicating my relationship with food and turning it into like numbers and maybe exchanges or following my rules so rigidly? So that's a hang up I see all the time. And yeah.
Yeah. Being someone who has done that kind of thing, like, it is so stressful and you like kind of can't be present in what you're doing. And also then maybe the impact on your body, depending on what your budget is and what your rules are. And then if you ate over the budget, like, that's a major stress. Like, it's just, I guess in my opinion now, I don't need that stress anymore. It wasn't worth it.
It's so well put. It's like, so simply, why are you holding on to that stress? Like, there must be a lot of fear behind that, you know, and where's that fear coming from? Cause I used to feel that way too. I used to, especially if you're a calorie counter, I see that a lot with the inner budgeter is going down to like literally the minuscule calorie and being like, I can't have this because it goes over budget. And if you do go over budget, there's guilt and shame. So there's a lot of ways to move beyond that. It's very complex and it depends on the person, but just starting to give yourself permission to be more flexible is really important. And it's part of recovery, right? Is having compassion for yourself if, you know, when you do go over that budget and recognizing that you probably need to in order to get better.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Number five. Okay. The final one. Oh my gosh. I feel like so many people can relate to that, to this one, is perfectionism in all levels of life. Like, one of the biggest hangups in recovery that I see is you go into recovery thinking you are going to be the perfect recovery student, right? Because a lot of us have a temperament where we, you know, like to be the best at what we do. We want to succeed. We are afraid of failure. So you approach recovery with this perfectionist mindset thinking, I'm not going to make any mistakes. I'm going to do everything the right way. I'm going to be the best at recovery. And what that creates is a lot of black and white thinking. So there's this either or mindset, either I'm doing it perfectly or I'm failing. And that causes so much suffering in a person, because who would want to feel like they're failing a lot of the time? So the ideal situation here is recognizing that recovery is not black and white. It's really about living inside the gray zone and recognizing, sometimes I'm going to be able to do this, but not all of the time. And like honoring the fact that, again, you learn from those failed attempts, right? And that having the expectation of perfection is only going to keep you in this maybe spiral of self-hatred, right? Because you're like constantly thinking, oh, I should be doing this better. So having patience for where you're at and recognizing recovery is very messy. It can feel really chaotic. It can feel really out of control. In fact, I feel like sometimes feeling out of control is a requirement of getting better. Like, you need to learn what it feels like to feel a little out of control. So it's a very messy process, and recognizing that you can't be perfect with it.
Yeah, I don't think we touched on it before. I know we were talking about kind of learning as you go along and taking action. I think it does stop people from taking action. I think it links to one of the previous ones you were talking about, because they're like, oh, but if I don't have this perfect goal, if this goal isn't the perfect goal, and again, not knowing what to pick, that week of like, oh, I should eat X food.
Yeah.
But if I don't eat that, then it's you know, like you said, the black and white thinking, it's just not worth it, or I'm just not gonna do it at all, rather than, well, maybe I'll eat this thing that's a bit similar to X, or I'll eat half of X, for example, if someone's trying to challenge fear foods.
Yeah, I think the black and white mindset, it's like the dieting bandwagon in reverse. You know how someone will be dieting and then they have their I hate this, but their little cheat day, and then they spiral. They're like, well, now I'm just gonna be off the diet, and they hate them. It's the same thing with recovery. It's like people fall off their recovery bandwagon in a way, and then they just fall deep into their eating disorder in that either or mindset. But why let one mistake or failed, quote, failed attempt in recovery ruin the next 4 days of recovery? Just let that experience stand alone. Okay, I did not do so great at lunch today. I did not challenge what I committed to my team I'd challenge or whatever it is. Don't say to yourself, the whole day's ruined, the whole week's ruined, I'm a failure. It's okay, let's take it one meal at a time. What's afternoon snack supposed to be? And let me tackle that. I can regain momentum just by taking that step, right? And then taking dinner and then evening snack or whatever that might look like for you, recognizing it doesn't have to be more than just one failed attempt. Just let it stand alone. Don't let it all blur together.
Yeah, I kind of talk to clients about like a lapse of like one thing's happened, a relapse, a string of them, or like a collapse, is like you were saying, like I'm just going to go back into all of those things that I did before. I'm realizing like it's not the end of the world. It's probably going to happen. I can't 100% say it's going to, but probably is, more than once. Yeah, I think it's hard though. Do you know if people almost get their self-worth from being a perfectionist? Or doing too good at them things, but then that's part of therapy too, to find those other areas of your life to get that good feeling about yourself from, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's one thing, like one of the recovery gifts that I gained and some wisdom I gained through my process is I was a perfectionist in other areas as well. So I was the perfect student. I studied for hours. If there was a 5-point quiz, I would be that person studying all night for a 5-point quiz. I just didn't have the self-trust to take it easy, you know? So I was that perfectionist. So recovery, because it is so messy and chaotic, and you have to learn to trust yourself. That actually not only fought my eating disorder, but I was able to fight that perfectionism. And now I'm okay with making mistakes. I'm okay with owning mistakes, learning from them. I see a lot of value in those failed attempts. And I trust that those failed attempts are just setting me up for learning. So it's been really nice to no longer be a perfectionist for sure.
Yeah, and what would you say to someone who came to you and said, I just want to eat normally?
Oh God. Wow, such a good question. Well, you know, of course, there's that part of me that would ask them, what does normal eating look like to you? You know, because it is different for everyone. And then once we defined what that looked like, I would probably give them a lot of reassurance and say, this feels really foreign to you right now, but it's not impossible. You can get to this point where you eat normally again. And, you know, however that looks like for you, it just takes patience and you have to unlearn so much of diet culture and challenge that eating disorder. So I would probably try to give that person so much reassurance in the moment. And then of course I would point them to resources. I could go on and on about what I would do, but that's what I would say.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much for coming. And where can people find you?
Yes. So I highly recommend people follow me on Instagram. It's just Meg_McCabe. I'm also on YouTube. I have the Meg and Ann Claire show on YouTube. It's brand new. It's only a few months old. The Recovery Collective is on Instagram. And then my website is meg-mccabe.com. But as we just made very obvious in the beginning of this episode, it's not going to be the most up to date. So that's where people can find me.
Thank you for listening to the Just Eat Normally podcast. I hope you found this enjoyable, interesting, and insightful and informative. And if you did, make sure to subscribe to hear the next episode. And just remember that you can check out the show notes for contact details and extra resources.